Brown.
This is he.
This is Brent Kelly. Mr. Brown, I wrote you a few months ago asking if I could ask you some questions about the period in the 50s when the bonus babies had to spend some time. Okay, I'm glad you remember. Good sign. Is this a good time where I can talk with you for a few minutes?
It's about as good as any, Brent.
Okay. Well, I really do appreciate this, sir. As I said in the letter, I'm trying to write a book on it. I'm progressing slowly, but that's nobody's fault but my own, but I'll get there. I'll ask you maybe a dozen questions or so. If you'd please just, answer as long or as short as you want, and, if you don't want to answer, don't. If you want to add, please do.
I'll do a little bit.
Thank you. 1953 was the year that the two-year rule began on the bonus babies. Before that, I guess it seemed like every 2 weeks there was a different bonus rule. Do you remember the genesis of this rule?
No, I certainly don't, Brent. We had so many different rules over the years, as you say, and none of them seemed to work.
Right.
And I'd say primarily, and I hate to say this, but because there was so much evading of the rule, skirting of the rule, or just plain cheating.
Mm-hmm.
And they tried to find a rule that was perfect and that one that was fair, and they never did come up with one.
Well, they sure didn't. Speaking of cheating, this was a question on down the line, but we'll cover it now. Everyone I've spoken with says there were rampant rumors of under-the-table payments and things like this. Only one, I don't know if you remember, Dave Skogstad, a pitcher with Cincinnati, he's the only one who came out and actually said that a team did offer him under-the-table money. He said the Red Sox offered him some. What was your knowledge of this at the time?
Well, I don't think that is quite right. The Baltimore Club was fined by the commissioner's office.
That's right. Yes, sir, that's right, yeah.
And the player was released, was taken away from them because of direct evasion of the rule.
That's right. It was a pitcher. Can't remember his name, but right. Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that.
I think he was in Texas. I'm not sure.
That sounds right, or Oklahoma.
Paul Richards was in Baltimore.
Yeah.
So that... the problem, of course, was to prove it.
Right.
And that was so very difficult to do. But there were so many rumors and so many claims, most of which were unsubstantiated, but it was evident to people in baseball that there was multiple evasions going on. There were some clubs that we felt were more guilty than others.
But there was no substantiation anywhere other than what somebody may admit today.
That's right.
Okay.
The bad part, of course, was that baseball has always held itself as a very clean sport.
Right.
And to have all of these rumors going around, and a lot of them published in newspapers, strictly as rumors, of course, and without naming names, clubs, or individual cases, it just wasn't good for the game.
Right. I spoke with Jim Campbell, it's been maybe 3 weeks ago, and he said that each time a new rule was made, by the time the people got out of the room, they were figuring out ways to evade it.
That's right.
It must have been a pretty harrowing era.
Everyone was interested, of course, in getting talent.
Right.
And so you had to figure out a way to get an edge on your competition. Of course, I think the thing that really made unnecessary any such bonus rule was the free agent draft.
Right.
It didn't make any difference. You had the rights to the player for a year. And you had to negotiate with that player, and you didn't have to outbid someone else.
Why was there so much resistance on the part of baseball to go to that? To the draft. Oh, just excuse me, I'm sorry.
There were clubs who had obvious edges.
Right.
For example, a team and the Yankees.
Mm-hmm.
For one thing, they were a big market team with more money to spend than others. And two, the Yankees had been such an attractive club for kids to sign with over the years. The Yankees and Notre Dame, you know, the winning clubs.
Right.
Had an attraction that... legislation.
This was, though, what, the 57 season was the last, it was, what, 7 or 8 years before they finally got around to the draft.
First draft, I think, was 65.
Well, going back to, I guess, what, 49, the signing by the Pirates of Paul Pettit, a very nice man, but a disastrous career. How much did this contribute to the bonus rule, the money he received?
I don't think it did at all.
Okay.
I don't think it did at all. I think if Paul Pettit were a free agent today, a high school free agent, he would get twice as much as he got then, at least twice as
mm-hmm.
much.
Yeah, with his talent.
Talent who injured himself.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. Now you can only speak for your team, but who made the final decision to sign these young men and give them this, well, at the time, was a tremendous amount of money?
Well, of course, I was not there in 49, but...
we're back up to 53 now. I'm jumping around. I'm sorry.
Well, I wasn't there until 56.
Oh, I thought you were there in 55. Okay, I'm sorry.
Well, no, I was there working for Mr. Rickey in 55.
Okay.
Replacing until the end of the 55 season. But in all organizations, the two people who make the final determination to give anybody big money, and that's one, ownership, and two, management, the general manager.
Mm-hmm.
The scouting director has to sell the general manager on the wisdom of giving large sums of money to untried youngsters. But in the final analysis, the money has to be made available by ownership.
Okay, but ownership is just approved, didn't actually enter into.
The ownership doesn't get down to analysis of the player talent.
Okay. That's why they hire these people, I guess.
That's right. That's why you have general managers. And all major decisions in a properly run organization are made by the general manager.
Well, the Pirates didn't lead the league in many things in those days, but they did lead them in bonus baby signees. And you saw most of these boys, some signed after you were there, some signed before, but were still there when you joined them. Was the proper groundwork done on these kids?
I would think so. It's the toughest thing in the world to know where a young man from 17 to 21, a high school graduate or a college junior, or college senior, you know, how he's going to develop.
Sure.
What opportunities are going to present themselves to him. There were some players that I inherited when I came to Pittsburgh who I think would have been fine major league players had they started where they belonged.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of the two O'Briens, for example, Johnny and Eddie O'Brien, who were bonused by Mr. Rickey, they were talented young men, but they had to stay in the major leagues for a couple of years. I'm not sure whether it was two or three.
It was two. It ended up being parts of three seasons because they usually signed in June or July,
right,
and had to go two full years.
So that they graduated from college like at 22, 21 or 22, and they were almost 24 by the time that they could go down.
Mm-hmm.
And they were good enough, so it was tough to send them down. They were good enough at least to stay on a 25-man roster. But I'm convinced that both of the O'Briens, and there were others, Art Swanson and Hugh Pepper, and I'm trying to think of some of the others.
Pritchard? Buddy Pritchard?
Pritchard was after I got there.
Yeah, he was the last bonus baby signed by the Pirates. He had a boy named Martin. Martin may have been gone, Paul Martin, before you got there.
He was signed by Mr. Rickey just before... He was signed under Strickey in 1955.
Uh-huh. And Nick?
He was released while I was there.
Nick Kobach?
Well, Nick Kobach was before. Yeah, that was
okay.
Mr. Rickey. Vic Janowitz was Mr. Rickey.
Janowitz was the first player signed by anyone under this rule. He looked like, early on, that it was going to be great. What happened to him?
Well, he hadn't played baseball for the whole time he was at Ohio State.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah. He played football only. His problem was he was just too rusty and he couldn't start on the major league level.
Okay, well, this is, I guess, the prime question is how detrimental was this rule to the players and to the team? Some of them overcame it. Lindy McDaniel and Al Kaline, I guess, gave early returns and eventually Killebrew and Koufax. But most of these boys started out slowly and went down from there. Was this strictly a function of not being ready?
Primarily, yes, and not being good enough to compete every day, to play every day.
Mm-hmm.
It took Koufax a long time before he achieved stardom.
Sure.
And had Koufax gone out where he could have gotten in 150 to 200 innings in minor league competition, he probably would have been ready at least three years before he was to take his rightful place as a great pitcher.
Mm-hmm.
Kaline was unusual. You know, there are exceptions to everything.
Of course.
To step right out of high school and to do as well immediately as he did,
mm-hmm.
most unusual.
What about the effect on the team? It had to be a killing effect on a team like the Pirates carrying four or five of these boys every year.
Well, it certainly didn't help them, but the rest of the talent wasn't all that good at the time.
Right.
And plus the fact that the talent that we did have early on was mostly young talent.
Mm-hmm.
So that you had some guys who had come up through the major league, to the major leagues, quicker than they might have with a better team.
Right.
Playing with kids who had been bonus. So the combination was tough.
Yes, yes it was. Dick Grote was before your time, and he doesn't fall under this rule, but he still received a bonus. The rule, I think, right before this was, and correct me if I'm wrong, they had to be called up, or at least put on a roster after the first year. Is that correct?
I don't remember that. The ramifications of all the rules stayed into oblivion as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
I'm glad they're gone.
Yes, sir. It was a horrible time.
Well, the worst rule we ever had was one where every first-year player was eligible for the draft.
Yes.
And it was so nonsensical. And I remember we finished sixth that year, and the Boston Red Sox finished sixth. And both of us lost eight players.
Oh, my Lord.
More than any other club.
Yeah.
We were penalized for scouting well.
Uh-huh.
And there were some decent players taken from us. One very good player. Bobby Tolan.
Oh, yeah. Excellent.
And a kid by the name of Roar, who pitched a one-hitter against the Yankees.
His first start, right.
Mm-hmm. I can't think of the other kid. Well, Byron Brown, who played in the major leagues for mm-hmm. a long time with the Cubs. And I guess he'd say a long time, probably 8 to 10.
Yeah, he was there for a while, that's for sure. Yeah, that when you're in sixth place and then lose that much talent, it does not help you go up at all, does it?
I remember I went down to our rookie club. We were playing Kingsport, Tennessee, and we had signed some good players. And I told our manager down there I didn't want him to play six of them. I said, you morning workouts, and you work with them and do your best to bring them along, but don't play them. Of the six, five were drafted. What had happened, of course, they were well known as free agents.
Right. The other teams were doing their homework, too.
That's right.
One of the problems the young men encountered, Jim Small is the one who suggested this book, and he said when he was at home in San Jose, he was he had to be in at 9 o'clock every night. And then here he is, just turned 18 years old, and he joins the Tigers. I think he said he joined them in New York. And there are people wanting to take his suitcase out of his hand and putting their hand out for money. He had eaten restaurants, and before that just wasn't done. He said the adjustment was just absolutely overwhelming, at least for him. How did this, at least in your observation, affect these young men?
I'm sure it had some effect on them. I, quite frankly, I never thought of that as having any harmful effect upon their career. You know, there's an adjustment to make just leaving home to going out to play at all.
Sure.
Playing in the minor leagues is probably a bigger adjustment than any place else, because people don't look after you quite as well. In the major leagues, you've got a traveling secretary who takes care of your baggage, and you know, you got your room all ready for you and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it's your kid glove treatment is apparent in the major leagues and not so much in the minor leagues. But I wouldn't think that it would affect too many players.
Okay.
Perhaps he was cobbled somewhat if he had to be in bed every night or home every night by 9. Certainly that isn't the case with kids today.
No, boy, sure. You beg to please come home by 11.
Please come home sometime.
Yeah, I've got a couple up in college right now. I've been through it. Okay, what was the attitude, at least in your observation, of the managers and the veteran players on the team to these kids that came in?
In our particular case, when I was there, I think they were happy to have them. I mean, they were good to them. But we were not going to compete to win in our early years. And by the time we got to 58, the first time that Pittsburgh had done anything in a long time, I think we finished second in 58. Those kind of kids either had earned their spurs in the major leagues and as contributing members of the club, or else they were gone.
Right.
But I think there was equality throughout baseball in that if they retained a player on a contending club, they knew that other clubs were doing the same or had to do it.
Right.
I don't know how many clubs, I've not made a study of it, but just in retrospect, it would seem to me that all the clubs, or most clubs, did it. One of the reasons some clubs didn't, and the main reason that we got Roberto Clemente is the Dodgers were unwilling to put him on their 25-man roster.
Mm-hmm. The Pirates, from the early 50s on, if you look at their roster, every year a significant, maybe not a rookie of the year, but a significant rookie was added. And by the time you got all these guys together at the end of the decade, it was just a marvelous lesson in how to develop a team.
Well, our scouting department did an awfully good job.
Mm-hmm.
And in the years that Mr. Rickey was there, club finished last, I believe, every year. But still, there were some players who later became very strong contributors.
Sure, Law and Friend and Groton. Clemente came on at that time, a lot of those guys.
Well, of course, Clemente was not a farm system kid. He was a draftee.
All right.
Roy Face and Dale Long. But I'm thinking of Groton and Skinner,
mm-hmm.
and Face and Law. Well, Face was a draftee, too.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Law and Friend. Yeah, Face was drafted from the Dodgers.
I didn't know that. I'll be darned.
And kept in Pittsburgh for a year and then sent down to New Orleans where Danny Murtaugh and I were together, and then went back up to Pittsburgh and helped. He came down there primarily to develop the forkball, which made him a great pitcher.
Mm-hmm. Sure did. Does he belong in the Hall of Fame? That's a different subject entirely. But
I think so, yes.
I do, too.
I'm looking at a painting of a man that I think definitely belongs here, and that's Bill Mazeroski.
Oh, by all means, yes, sir.
Not just for his home run, but for the quality of his performance throughout a very fine career.
I had a book published last year called The Case for Those Overlooked by the Hall of Fame, and I included Mazeroski in it. There's no justification whatsoever for him not being in.
Well, I'm in complete agreement. I think Face was the best relief pitcher of certainly my first 15 years in the game. Some who came along later, of course.
Yeah. Well, the philosophy of relief pitching has changed drastically over the years. If he were pitching with today's philosophy, his save total would be so much greater. And people don't consider that. They just look at the total and do not think it's quite as impressive as Reardon, but I'd take him over Reardon any day of the week.
Absolutely.
We're getting a little far afield. Well, you talked about, we mentioned this is about trying to cheat on the rule, and this has nothing, but were you aware that when Cleet Boyer joined the A's as a bonus baby he was actually signed with Yankee money?
No, I was not.
Okay, I don't know if anybody was aware at that time, but that was the case. The Yankees used Kansas City as their farm team, obviously, and they didn't want to carry Boyer, so they made a deal that Boyer would play for the A's until they could trade for him after his bonus time was up, which I think that's almost funny if it weren't so obviously sneaky. One last question, Mr. Brown, and I think you've probably answered this in many different ways, but your opinion of this particular rule that required the two-year stay?
Well, I think it was unfair to the clubs. I think it was unfair to the players, and it didn't accomplish the purpose.
Okay. I think that pretty much sums it up. Well, Mr. Brown, I really appreciate your time. I hope I haven't taken you from something
else.
Happy
to talk with you. I wish I were a little more clear on a lot of the things.
Oh, boy, you've been absolutely great compared to some of the fellows I've spoken with. Really, you have been, your memory is marvelous for going back 40 years, and I really appreciate it. I believe me, I'll need it, but thank you. Do you want to see anything that pertains to you or any quotes I attribute to you before it goes to print?
Not at all necessary. I'm sure you won't misquote me.
Well, no, life's too short for that, but I always offer because I don't want to be accused of something.
That's not at all necessary.
Okay. Mr. Brown, thank you very much. If I come up with another question, may I call back?
Please do.
Okay, thank you very much.
Bye-bye.